This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. With coronavirus cases continuing to surge, researchers are moving quickly to develop a vaccine and therapies for COVID-19, and some of that research is happening right here in Central Florida. I talked to three people contributing to the fight to get COVID-19 under control. Seminole County Elementary School teacher Jinx Coleman is heading back to the classroom, and she's worried about her health and the health of the kids she teaches and her co-workers. She volunteered to take part in a vaccine trial. Dr. Bruce Rankin is the Medical Director of Excel Clinical Research in DeLand, the Central Florida site for the nationwide trial. And Dr. Stephen Smith is Chief Scientific Officer with Advent Health, where research into treatment is underway. Thank you all for joining me. Jinx, I want to start with you. You put your hand up to take part in a vaccine trial, and I wonder if you could just kind of explain, you know, your rationale for saying, okay, this is something I want to do, and what that trial entails for you.
Okay, well, to begin with, I'm a teacher of elementary kids, second grade teacher. So we know where we are with that, having to go back into the classroom, that being one of the options. And I knew that also I am 65 years old with underlying medical conditions. And when I heard about the trial study, I decided, well, you know what, I'd rather be part of the solution than the problem. Hopefully with the vaccine, you know, I can build up the antibodies that are necessary and not just, you know, keep the kids safe and also myself.
So what does it mean for you? Like, what do you actually have to do to take part in this trial?
Well, yesterday I went and went into clinic, and we were all taken into, there were about six of us in that at that time, and we were taken into separate rooms with our own nurse. We were given obviously all the legal information we had to read through. That was 26 pages, and we're supposed to receive a vaccine. Now, it's a control group, so obviously there's also going to be part of it's going to be somebody's going to be receiving a placebo, and I was hoping it wasn't me. But and we're going to be monitored. We have a diary that we fill out every evening. If there is any inflammation or redness or whatever, we've been given a type of gauge in order to measure that. We record it. We have to take our temperature. We also were told that if, in fact, we do happen to end up with COVID, the COVID-19, not because of this, but through other means, that report to our regular doctor and also to contact them. And there's a list of things that we're supposed to follow. So our next, they're calling me back in. There'll be two doses. They'll call me back in about 3 weeks, and we'll receive the second dose.
Are you worried at all? Like any kind of concern about potential side effects? Because this is all fairly new science, right?
Yes, it is new science. I read the information that was provided prior to actually going over there and taking the injection yesterday. And initially I was, oh yeah, I'm into this. I've got to do my part. And then, you know, I was telling my teacher friends, and they're like, are you sure you want to do that? You know, is that safe? And then, so of course, I started backing off of it. And then I started doing more reading about the past studies, the earlier studies. And I became confident that this was the right thing to do. My daughter, who was a nurse, and she's against it, but the rest of my family is okay with it.
Well, Dr. Stephen Smith with Advent Health, I want to bring you into this conversation. There's a lot of research going on in Central Florida, right, into COVID-19, and in fact, across the world, because this is a pandemic and people are pretty keen to find a solution for it. What is Advent Health doing in terms of whether vaccine trials or therapies for the impacts of COVID-19?
It's really a combination of several approaches that we're taking. So first off, you mentioned there's a lot of research going on around the world. And so we have a team of librarians, clinicians, and other researchers and scientists. And we bring that information into databases and discuss and review And then we actually have the opportunity to change the way we care for patients based on that research. And we've done that since the very beginning of the pandemic. The other thing that we've been really focused on early in the pandemic is therapies in the hospital. So we know that COVID produces a variety of different really challenging medical conditions, not just with pneumonia and cough and, you know, the things most people would think about, but it really affects every organ in the body. So we've been doing research in the hospital around what the most effective therapies are for people who have to be admitted to the hospital. I'll give you an example of that. We know that one of the big things that COVID does in some, but not all people, is it causes the immune system to go haywire and become overactive. And there are a variety of different very novel medications that have been used in other diseases that very early in the pandemic were applied to this problem, which we call cytokine storm, this overactive immune system. And so we've done several trials that have now informed us really the best place to use these, what the best medications are. And those trials were conducted in our critical care units and in our hospital. And that work continues. Honestly, we get, you know, 7 or 8 opportunities to do hospital-based clinical trials every week, almost one a day. So the U.S. Pharmaceutical Company and a lot of researchers all around the world are really coming up with some novel approaches to treat COVID.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything really surprising in the last 3-4 months? Because, you know, the disease has really, it's really thrown up a lot of challenges, right?
Yeah, it has. I think what we're learning is, particularly with regards to acute care hospitalized treatment, is that we've learned and brought those into the ICUs in a way that has really reduced mortality from COVID quite dramatically. And so some of it is new medications, and you know we had. Data you heard about on remdesivir, the antiviral that was supposed to stop, you know, we now know that that it works, but it's not the whole answer. These drugs that can turn off the immune system when it goes haywire have been extremely effective. And then there's other things like how we use ventilators most effectively, how we prevent clots from forming in the legs and lungs and other places. So it's not just one thing that's helping us reduce mortality. It's a whole variety of research efforts. And so I think there's probably not going to be a silver bullet here, but there will be, you know, good evidence that we can incorporate into care that makes a big difference in the lives of our patients.
Dr. Bruce Rankin, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your role with the vaccine trial underway right now in Central Florida.
Sure. We obviously, when we're doing research, we need to test the vaccine. And so we're at the point now where we're starting larger in-human trials for vaccine testing. You know, when we look at that, we want to make sure they're safe before we give it to the general population. And we also want to make sure that they're going to be effective and help reduce the symptoms of the disease, or maybe even hopefully prevent the disease itself. And after the vaccine, when people develop antibodies, we need to try and maintain immunity of some type. So a vaccine can be powered to help maintain our immunity moving forward. So as we're over and over exposed to the virus, we're able to be ready with our immune system to ward it off. So vaccines will play an important role. Dr. Smith talked about the treatments, which is obviously we need to improve and continue to look at and do research. And the COVID patients that are most severe, obviously, in those hospital settings, both in the severe unit and ICU. So our part and role is going to be to bring in large numbers of patients. Most of the trials are powered for around 30,000 nationwide. And It is a placebo-controlled. We have to be able to differentiate between getting no vaccine and getting a vaccine that powers it for the endpoint of being effective, and monitor those antibody levels that are produced, and also the incidences of disease, the COVID-19 disease, after somebody is in the trial. So both trials we're working on currently are powered for over 24 months to try and look at those endpoints. So we're excited to be a part of this and help out. We've been doing vaccine trials for about 20 years here in Deland. And so it's something we've been working on, other indications. And obviously, this is a very timely and important trials that are coming through right now.
And so you're with SL Clinical Services. And my understanding is this, you know, your unit is the only location in Central Florida, at least for the clinical trial. But there's a lot of people involved, right? I mean, what is it, 30,000 across the entire country are going to be involved in this trial?
So the trials that we're currently enrolling, there's about 80 to 90 sites nationwide. We were picked as one of those sites. There are multiple pharmaceutical companies looking at vaccine products. So we will probably have quite a few trials going on simultaneously as some more come into human testing. They do small numbers first, obviously. We do have a phase one unit where it's first in human, but our trials currently are phase three. So they've been tested on small numbers of people and look for the initial results before we start testing larger numbers. So the idea is to increase the numbers and start getting some of that data that we need to see how effective these vaccines are going to be. But there'll be many vaccines. Currently, I don't have the exact number, but there'll be many vaccine trials going on probably through the fall and into the winter, I'm sure.
Do you get the sense that a lot of people want to put their hand up because they're like, well, this could give me a jump start on, you know, protecting myself? Or is there, like, what are the range of reasons people volunteer for these trials?
There are a host of reasons. The main one is people, obviously, this is a very national topic and world topic right now, and people want to get involved to do their part to try and help. So that's one thing we see. People goes, we need to do something for this. I'm here to do my part. Some of our trials are geared for looking for those high-risk essential workers, those ones that will be exposed to the virus more likely, the ones that are our first responders, our healthcare workers, our doctors, our nurses that are in COVID units that may have not had the infection yet, but would like to have a chance to possibly get an effective vaccine. Those things will be told. But the grocery store workers, the ones that are going in every day and knowing that with the amount of numbers we have now, they're going to be exposed. So those people will have an opportunity to come in and help us with the vaccine development. So that's the main reason I see them come in.
And Jinx, I want to turn back to you. You're a teacher, so you're going to be exposed to a lot of kids every day. And the, you know, the teachers that I've talked to are worried not just about, of course, their own health, but they're concerned about their kids too and the other folks that they're working with. Do you kind of feel like a frontline worker in that regard, Jinx?
Yes, I do. I do.
And do you know other people who are saying, look, I might be interested in putting my hand up for a vaccine trial?
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I came in to sign in this morning at my school, one of the secretaries said, well, how did you find out about the study? You know, I might be interested in doing something like that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking about the quest for a vaccine and treatments for COVID-19 with Jinx Coleman, who volunteered for a vaccine study, Dr. Bruce Rankin, Medical Director of Excel Clinical Research in Deland, and Dr. Stephen Smith, Chief Scientific Officer with Advent Health. Stay with us. We'll continue the conversation in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the quest for a vaccine and treatments for COVID-19 with Jinx Coleman, who volunteered for a vaccine study, Dr. Bruce Rankin, Medical Director of Excel Clinical Research in Deland, and Dr. Stephen Smith, Chief Scientific Officer with Advent Health. Dr. Stephen Smith, I wonder about the kind of pace of the research. Like, is it unusual to be having vaccine trials going on, trying out all these new therapies, some of them kind of experimental, and having this all happen simultaneously? Is that sort of a weird situation to be in?
Yeah, this is really unprecedented. I mean, we went from the arrival of a virus to a whole portfolio in a new, you know, with a new disease in a matter of weeks. For example, we had one one trial that we were approached with on a Sunday, and we opened it up on Friday in the intensive care unit, and started treating people Friday night. So, you know, this is moving really, really fast. You know, the other thing that, you know, we've been doing that's really exciting is the ability to provide what's called convalescent plasma to our patients. And for our listeners today, you know, this is taking the plasma, not the red cells of the blood, but the plasma from the blood, and giving it to people who have COVID from people who've been exposed and recovered. And, you know, that's a really a big part of our therapeutics that we use at Advent Health, particularly in the intensive care unit. And we're seeing really rapidly engineered antibodies. In other words, instead of having the body create its own antibodies, we can create them basically in big vats and purify them and give them to people, just like convalescent plasma. And we're starting studies now to test, you know, how those might work in hospitalized patients. So, you know, the technology is moving fast, and it's really amazing the variety of ways that scientists from all over the world are starting to think about fighting this particular virus. That they're not always traditional ways of how we may have thought in the past. We're getting very creative in this. I could talk maybe a little bit more about some of those, but the technology that's being deployed here is really amazing and fast too.
Is the jury still out a little bit on convalescent plasma?
So we have good data now on the safety of convalescent plasma. We haven't had really a formal report from a published study to say that it's efficacious. We do know that the approach has been very efficacious with essentially every other case that it's been used historically. It does appear to be efficacious as an approach. But again, you're absolutely right, Matthew. We don't have that pivotal study out there. Word from some of our colleagues around the country is that's in progress right now.
Jinx, if I could come back to you for a moment. I know that, you know, we look at the numbers every day. Have you been sort of pretty careful about maintaining your personal bubble and making sure you're taking all the precautions that health experts are advising?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, I'm sitting here looking. I've got my face mask here. I've got my hand sanitizer. I've got my gloves. I don't go anywhere without them. So, and, you know, do all of the precautions. And I've stayed at home. I've stayed at home as often, you know, as I could.
That's going to get a little more challenging, though, as we look towards the reopening of schools, right, and that school term gets going again.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, especially with little kids, I mean, here in Seminole County, where it's still, they're at the bargaining table right now as we speak, talking about, you know, what are the guidelines? What are we going to look at for the teachers who are going back into the classrooms for the face-to-face? And, you know, are we going to be distancing? You know, are we going to be following the CDC guidelines, you know, with 6 feet between students? You know, we do know that our superintendent is asking that all masks be worn within the classroom at all times. So, I mean, yes, that's a step in the right direction. But, you know, the parents were given the option of virtual school connect, and there's a face-to-face, and for the kids who are coming face-to-face, that's great. I chose to be in the classroom. This is probably my last year of teaching because of my age, but I want to be here. I want to be here in a safe as possible environment for both the kids and for me because of my family and my grandkids. However, we need to set up safe guidelines for everybody to follow. And another one of those things is, as kids or as parents feel safer about returning their kids to the classroom, that the teachers who did choose face-to-face, we've got to be careful about the number of students within those classrooms because we should not be overburdened with heavier class loads.
So it's interesting kind of thinking, Jinx, about some of the kind of challenges and the physical things, like the simple things that people are being told to do to try and keep themselves safe. And in the meantime, in the background, there's this sort of massive scientific effort underway to find a cure and a vaccine for coronavirus. Back to you, Dr. Bruce Rankin. Realistically, you know, what do you think we're looking at in terms of a workable vaccine here, or is it just too hard to predict at this point?
It's extremely hard to predict. Some of the comments I've heard earlier about how things are moving. Typical vaccine trials for us are a 6 to 8 year process. So right now, years are like, you know, months. So we're moving along very quickly. We're all very hopeful that this will be looked at and found to be effective and safe. And I'm saying and thinking that sometime by the first quarter of next year, we should start to be able to look at some of the analysis that we're doing now. And obviously, you know, they're putting the cart before the horse with a lot of this. We've already have vaccine that's being manufactured and produced and being on the ready. If the results are showing that they are effective. So that's something that we've never heard of before, where you're spending money on millions and millions of doses of vaccine that haven't even been tested yet. So I think things are aligning to try and get that herd immunity that we're looking for when we find, and there may be several vaccines that end up having some effect, and they may be stratified for different types of individuals and have different effects in different groups. So the timelines are moving very fast, like Dr. Smith mentioned, and I'm hoping by the first quarter of next year, people will have an option to come in to their clinics, their pharmacies, and get vaccinated when know that it's going to be effective to help slow the progression of this and transmission of this disease.
Jinx, how does it feel knowing that you might be part of a trial that actually does yield a successful vaccine?
I feel wonderful about it. I mean, that's the whole point, is like we need to, this is very important research, and we need to find a cure because it affects all of us. You know, so sounds like a good idea to me.
Indeed. Dr. Smith, one of the things that I'm wondering about is, you know, for previous outbreaks of COVID diseases like SARS, et cetera, I don't believe there were vaccines yielded from studies of those. Or am I wrong in that? Like, have some of those previous outbreaks not actually ended up with a vaccine?
It turns out that there were many in development when particularly, you know, the second outbreak occurred. And what ended up happening is that the money wasn't put in to fully develop those vaccines at that point in time. So there are, I'm aware of many, many, many doses sitting in freezers of those vaccines that were developed with MERS and SARS. And there are actually efforts to try to get those out of the freezers and into clinical trials at this point in time. So, yeah, there was a lot of knowledge, actually, that those two prior coronavirus outbreaks provided for the scientific community. And honestly, a lot of vaccines were put on the shelf at that point in time. And so that's, you know, that's really part of the need for us to prepare for these kind of things in advance. And I think a long-term strategy around how we handle other potential outbreaks, not with coronaviruses, but we're working on that, obviously, but with other viruses and other things that can produce a similar pandemic.
Do you think this pandemic is kind of teaching us about the need to maybe put more into research, whether it's at the kind of hospital system level or just, you know, nationwide?
Yeah, I think we've learned a lot about emergency preparedness for big pandemics from this. And I would hope that we develop a concerted approach as a nation and indeed a global response to, you know, other outbreaks that have been predicted. And so I think this is a really good wake up call for all of us, particularly our leaders at the national level to make make plans. I can say this, that, you know, we here in Central Florida watched, I think, with wide open eyes about what was going on in other parts of the world, Europe in particular, but also New York. And so we had advanced preparation time. And I think that was you know, it was only a few months, but it made a big difference in how we were able to care for our patients here in Central Florida. So I do think we're much better poised now to really continue the COVID fight, which I predict is going to last a long time. And all of our epidemiologists and senior physician experts in infectious diseases, and the data certainly bearing this out, COVID's going to be with us for a while.
At this point in time, you know, some 4+ months into the pandemic, what do you think the future looks like over the next 4 months?
Well, it's a little uncertain, but there are certain things that we do know. And let me just say that, and that is that we know that the three key individual responsibilities that we can make a difference in what the infection rates are out there, and that's wearing a mask, hand washing, and social distancing. And, you know, finally here in the last week, we're beginning to see a break in this second and larger surge. You know, this surge that's happening right now was, you know, four times, maybe almost five times bigger than the original surge, which we prepared for. And, you know, I think we're going to see, unless people really get serious about social distancing, wearing masks, and doing the things that we know that work, we're going to see this around at these rates for a very long time. That's not what I hope for. But certainly we're seeing a little bit of an edge on the backside of this surge, but that could come back very quickly. And there are some concerns about what it means to be opening schools and what that might do for the larger population as a whole. So we're cautiously optimistic that we're seeing this little decline, but we're clearly not out of the woods yet.
Dr. Bruce Rankin, in the last couple minutes or so we have here, what does the next few months look like for you? I imagine you're going to be pretty busy too.
We're ramped up right now. We're going to be extremely busy. We're trying to get in a good number of patients to come in, participate in this vaccine trial. So our staff and our site will be very busy. If people are interested in contacting or getting more information, there is a website I'd like to mention real quick, covidorlando.com. You can get more information about the trials, the site, and we are only taking people in by appointments. So you need to come in with an appointment. The whole process time will take 1.5 to 2 hours. We watch you after you get your vaccine to make sure that everything looks like you tolerated it well. So we are taking patients by appointment, and but we plan on being extremely busy, full schedules. We're going to try and do our part to really get a lot of data in there as quickly and as effectively as possible, so we can get it back up to the statisticians and the people looking at these endpoints and get us some results on if this is something that's going to be effective.
Well, Dr. Bruce Rankin is the Medical Director of Cell Clinical Research, DeLand. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Rankin.
Thank you, Matt.
Also joined by Dr. Stephen Smith. He's the Chief Scientific Officer with Advent Health. Thank you, Dr. Smith.
It's a pleasure to be here, and help us tell our story about the great research that's going on here in Central Florida.
And I want to thank you also, Jinx Coleman. She's taking part in the clinical trial of the vaccine underway. Jinx, thanks as well, and good luck.
Well, thanks. I am just trying to do my part to help out.
Still to come, SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule splashed down off the coast of Florida over the weekend, enthralling spectators worldwide. So what's next for space exploration after this milestone for America's commercial space industry? This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Amid the grim headlines over the last few months, one bright spot has been the SpaceX Crew Dragon mission. Last weekend, the spacecraft splashed down off the coast of Florida with astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley on board, enthralling spectators online and in person, some of them getting just a bit too close. The mission marks a triumphant return to human space launches from the US. Joining me are Emily Speck, digital journalist and space reporter for WKMG. Emily, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne. Brendan, thanks as well.
Anytime.
So this was a pretty big deal, right? In many ways, the splashdown of those two astronauts, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, in the Gulf of Mexico over the weekend. Your reactions first, Brendan. What was kind of going through your mind as you were watching the footage of that little spacecraft hurtling through the atmosphere?
I found myself holding my breath, Matt, when the first set of chutes opened and then were cut before the second set of chutes, I realized I wasn't breathing. And because, you know, this has been a long process to get to this point. There have been countless tests, countless hurdles, technical challenges. I mean, we all remember the, you know, Easter weekend explosion of the, you know, the Draco thrusters, you know, while on a test stand. Emily and I have covered, you know, issues with parachutes development on this capsule. So to see it finally work and to know how much work went into it, it was, I breathed a sigh of relief. And I think there was a collective sigh of relief from everybody at SpaceX and NASA.
Emily, to Brendan's point about, you know, the sense of relief when you see those parachutes open, this is a throwback, right? I mean, the last time a spacecraft carrying human splashdown, of course, it was in the Pacific, but the last splashdown with astronauts was back in 1975, the tail end of the Apollo program. Just put that in context, if you could. What does this kind of mean for how spaceflight is going from here on out?
Yeah, everyone kind of keeps referencing this as an Apollo throwback splashdown style landing, but really, the challenges for both SpaceX and Boeing to develop these parachutes, we heard from NASA officials over and over that that was one of the most challenging aspects of developing these spacecraft to carry astronauts. So, you know, comparing the two programs, yes, there are some things in common, but this is a completely new spacecraft, completely new parachute design. And they tested those parachutes a lot, like even more so than I think NASA had required. So yeah, seeing them work and seeing even afterwards that they were able to be collected so they can get important data from them and make sure that they held up really well, that was good to see. The important thing is being able to collect them and see how well they held up when they were deployed. And they worked really flawlessly, slowing the spacecraft down first with the drogue parachutes and then the main parachutes, kind of seeing that, you know, slow down from around, I think, 350 miles an hour down to, what was it, like 15 miles an hour at splashdown. So they worked.
I remember talking to a source during the parachute testing, and they, you know, talked about the challenges of this. And they were like, yeah, we went to go check the textbooks on these, you know, hypersonic parachutes, and they were literally written in the 1970s by these Apollo guys. And so a lot of these companies were actually consulting with some Apollo engineers to kind of figure out, but they had to reinvent the parachute. It's kind of like an untold story about this, which was just spectacular to see it. It's successful and work just as well as they planned.
Emily, I was kind of intrigued by some of the terminology they were using. Once the spacecraft splashed down, they were saying it's stable one, which means it's in good shape and it's upright, and stable two apparently is on the water but on its side. And then just kind of listening to some of the technology, they have like a special ballast system to pump the water in and kind of keep it upright. Is this spacecraft also kind of like a lifeboat in some ways, and maybe more so than the old Apollo craft?
Oh, yes. Yeah, this is very different than the Apollo spacecraft. You know, Crew Dragon was designed so that no matter how it splashed down in the water, these astronauts were going to be okay and stable, and they would be able to get the spacecraft. But yeah, when you're watching it and you watched in the live stream, the spacecraft looked extremely solid. They also had great landing conditions. I know they consider the waves and how when the spacecraft comes down and how the waves kind of surround the spacecraft. So those are all things they have to consider, which when you think about it, it kind of sounds like a boat or a vessel of some kind. You did see the astronauts kind of had to hang out in the spacecraft for about an hour longer than maybe they would like to. And it's because they did kind of a sniff test around the spacecraft, which I was thinking, what does that mean? But it's not like sniffing with your nose. They use special instruments to smell for potentially hazardous and explosive chemicals. So the levels were a little higher than they wanted to. So that's why they kind of diffused for a little bit and waited until they could get out. And Doug Hurley said, hey, I'm fine. Let's just play it safe. So they basically waited for those levels to get completely down to zero before opening the hatch, and everything was okay.
And to your point earlier, Emily, there had been that explosion on the test stand when they were given the thrusters a test drive to see how they worked, and that didn't go so well. Just explain a little bit what happened there, and you know how much they had to do to make sure there was nothing like that was going to happen at all once astronauts strapped into this thing?
Oh gosh, that seems so long ago. So going back to it, there was essentially a part that they needed to replace in the spacecraft. So they determined what that issue was, what the part was, and they went in and to replace it. And I believe, and Brendan, correct me if you remember the name of the part, but it was like a disc mechanism that they needed to replace. And the explosion that we saw from that with the bright orange tinted smoke, that was from one of those chemicals that we talk about that are hazardous and why they don't want people near the spacecraft. Kind of what caused that billowing smoke that we saw from Cape Canaveral and across Brevard County. So I don't know, Brenda, do you remember off the top of your head what the name of that part was?
Yeah, it was a blast disc or something like that. And basically it was a disc that acted like a valve that would just blow through whenever it needed. So they replaced it with a more mechanical disc, because the problem with these fuels is, well, not the problem with these fuels, the good thing about these fuels and why they're used for these abort scenarios and used for, in space flight, is that when these two mix together, they explode. And that's where your thrust comes from. You don't need an ignition source. They don't like each other. There's an immediate reaction. So that's why they're so dangerous when they're they're not controlled. But it's also a perk to have this. You don't need an ignition source if you need to get out in a hurry or if you're in the vacuum of space. So that's kind of what these fuels are for. They replaced them and did quite a few tests. We saw the in-flight abort test before this, so they were able to get on top of that.
If you're just joining me, my guests are 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne and digital journalist and space reporter for WKMG Emily Speck. We're talking about the successful return to Earth of Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, the two NASA astronauts who spent a couple of months up on the International Space Station after rocketing up there on SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule, a return to flight from US soil for the United States. And speaking of that fuel, I mean, it's not only highly volatile, it's toxic too, right? And they had to actually make sure there was none of it sort of billowing around the spacecraft in the water before they could grab it and stick it on the boat.
Yeah, so when the spacecraft lands, there's only a few boats that are supposed to be in the area. And basically a fast boat kind of approaches the spacecraft, and they kind of look around the spacecraft and check out it's okay. And then there's, I think it's technically a diver that gets on the spacecraft and hooks the rig up there that they then use a boat to pull the spacecraft onto a larger boat, which in this case is called Go Navigator. So yeah, that is something they are looking at to make sure that there's no leaks around the spacecraft. They're looking at the water. And that's why it's so, so important that the area is cleared.
And we saw that was patently not the case. I mean, they had some footage. You could see a ring of spectator boats surrounding it. What was the kind of feedback from that?
Well, for context, they were not supposed to be there. You know, there were only supposed to be, I think it's up to four boats. And then the Coast Guard said they cleared the area. But what we heard from NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine then, that after the landing, and you could see it coming down, you know, for miles away, these boaters just made a beeline for the spacecraft, which was not good, because then it meant that the recovery teams had to deal with, you know, making sure the astronauts were safe and the spacecraft was secured, but then also telling all these boaters to leave the area. So we heard from NASA and SpaceX CEO Gwynne Shotwell that next time it will not go down this way. They will have more security for sure. We hear from the Coast Guard yesterday that some of the issues were the fact that they don't really have jurisdiction in that area of the water because of how far it was out. It's technically international waters. They didn't have the resources to get on all of those boats, because when you look at the photos, it was more than a dozen boats. So they couldn't really force everyone out, but they asked them to leave and they still stuck around.
Is it just kind of a function of the era we're into, where it's a lot easier to sort of track what's happening with things? I mean, you can track where the recovery vessels are going. So does it just make it easier for spectators to get out there if they want to?
The GPS location of the landing was out there. So it was not hard to find. And, you know, like I said before, when the capsule was coming down, you could see it from quite a distance away. So, you know, if those boaters were hanging out in a group together and saw it and were probably like, hey, that's the spacecraft, and just kind of, like the administrator said, made a beeline for it, that's kind of what happened. And I know some of us space reporters talked about it and were like, yeah, that would be so cool to be there, but to not understand why you shouldn't be there and then to be told to leave and then not leave, just, it boggled my mind. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Emily can attest to this, but, you know, when we go to see spacecraft as they're being prepped for launches, there are these hypergolic fuels that are loaded into them. And Emily and I, just as reporters, sit through, you know, an almost hour-long safety briefing to know how to be, just to physically be in the same space as this stuff that is in a very, very controlled environment. So for it to be uncontrolled on an untested vehicle that has just come back from space, that's bobbing around in the ocean, you definitely don't want to be around these fuels. And I'm sure a few heartbeats were skipped in mission control when they saw folks, you know, kind of converging on this, just because of just how dangerous and toxic those fuels are.
In spite of the, you know, little delay where the astronauts had to wait on board the spacecraft before they could pop the door open and get them out, they were back on dry land pretty quickly, right? And it's a bit different from the Apollo era when they would land somewhere out in the Pacific. It would take a while to get out to them. And, you know, that was probably not a very pleasant sort of wait for those Apollo era astronauts for the rescue craft.
Yeah, no, they definitely had it made on this one. You know, once they do land in the water, they're able to, the seats actually can adjust. So Bob and Doug were able to, they adjusted their seats so they were reclined and they could look out the window, which if anybody's been on a boat or a cruise ship before, that's definitely helpful with seasickness. They're brought onto the boat. They're taken in on stretchers, which seemed to just be a formality because both of them were sitting straight up once they got out of the capsule. They're given a medical evaluation and then a helicopter ride back to the closest port. So had we not had a tropical system off of the east coast of Florida, they probably would have landed either in Cape Canaveral or Jacksonville. They would have stopped off in Kennedy Space Center and then flown to the Johnson Space Center. So they got almost planes, trains, and automobiles. They did what? Spacecraft, boats, helicopters, and private jets to get them back home.
Pretty much.
What about the Space Dads hashtag? What's going on with that?
Well, so both Bob and Doug are dads. They have two young sons, and they're both married to astronauts. Bob is married to a current astronaut, Megan MacArthur, and she's actually going to ride on the same spacecraft, the International Space Station, next spring. So,
wow.
Hashtag cool parents, because Megan and Bob are pretty awesome parents to have. And then Doug Hurley's wife is a retired astronaut, so Karen Nyberg. So they're just, I mean, they're dads, which I think helps put it into context that even though these are astronauts, they can fly upside down, they can do all these amazing things, they can spacewalk, but they're still people, they're still humans, they're still parents. And I know that a lot of the SpaceX team and NASA team, they would refer to them as the space dads. So that was kind of just a cute like moniker that they would use throughout the mission.
Astronauts become sort of personalities, right? I mean, they're part of their job, not the most important job, of course, but part of their job is kind of selling NASA to the public and, you know, selling the science to make people realize its value. And we've seen a lot of astronauts sort of take center stage, you know, perform songs in space and do kind of cool tricks to keep people interested in the space program. Do we get any dad jokes from the space dads while they're up there?
I do remember hearing that while they were waiting in the spacecraft, Doug Hurley used an emergency satellite phone that they had in the capsule to make some prank calls while he was waiting to get pulled up. I'm sure there were some dad jokes. We'll have to go scrub through some of the transcripts and find them.
I know. I bet they have some cool stories to tell because they were up there with NASA astronaut Chris Cassidy, and he knows both of the astronauts really well, and he's kind of a character himself. So the three of them had a pretty good time.
I mean, these astronauts have been in the Corps for, you know, Bob and Doug are, they're called the Bugs, is their astronaut class, because they were around in 2000 when the Y2K bug was, you know, all the buzz. I mean, these guys are, you know, they've been in the Corps, they've made the relationships, they know how to do the public outreach. They were just, you know, the perfect two to launch on this mission.
To the point about sort of rekindling interest in space, has this mission done it? I mean, it's been a success from go to woe. They've launched in a pretty troubling time for the United States, in fact, the entire world, right? In the middle of a pandemic. So has this rekindled some interest in what NASA is doing and just space exploration in general?
I feel like we're both biased about this, that we think, of course, this is just the coolest story, and we love that it's happening. But to kind of put some numbers on it, so on Sunday when this was happening, we had a tropical storm coming up the coast, right? We're in the middle of a pandemic. And I looked at our, we use a tool called Chartbeat to analyze how our website is doing and what people are clicking on. And our landing story had more people on it, and our live stream had about 1,300 people on it at one time, or I'm sorry, 1,600 people on it at one time. And so they were just like, we don't care about tropical storm. We don't care about the pandemic right now. We're going to watch these two space dads land. So that just really made me excited that people were also very excited about this landing, and they took a break from all the other things that they could be paying attention to right now to watch this historic event. So that kind of helped me put a numerical interest in what that was like for everyone else too.
Mm-hmm.
Brendan, what's next then? I mean, there's another mission fairly soon, right, from SpaceX. They're going to send a Dragon capsule up to the space station again in fairly short order. And then Boeing is also kind of fine-tuning some of what it's doing with the Starliner. So what are the next steps for the Commercial Crew Program?
Well, right now NASA will review this mission. So this was technically a test mission, the final test mission of this spacecraft. And they'll do some reviews and then go ahead and give a go for the first operational mission, which is three NASA astronauts and a Japanese astronaut sometime later this year. I mean, this basically is now changes NASA's trajectory like it has never been before. This is a paradigm shift for the way the agency works with commercial partners. This is the first time a commercially designed, developed, and launched vehicle has taken NASA astronauts to space, and it's a completely different way for the agency to do business. And it has kind of already laid the groundwork for new developments in how NASA procures contracts, like human landers and stuff. They're no longer saying, "Hey, private industry, these are our plans. Build this." They're saying, "Hey, private companies, we need to go here. How are you going to get us there?" To see how that kind of takes shape is going to be really incredible to see over the next 5 years. So to watch that operational mission, as Emily mentioned, they already have another operational mission planned, which is two American astronauts and a European astronaut and then another Japanese astronaut on the next one. SpaceX is going. And the fact now that there's going to be, four American astronauts or four astronauts on the U.S. side of the International Space Station on this next mission totally opens up more science to be done on the International Space Station. That's really what the scientists are really excited about. So just having that is incredible. And as you mentioned, Boeing is still working out some kinks in its plans and has to do another demonstration flight. But just once Boeing comes on board, whenever that may be, the capabilities of what we can do in low Earth orbit are almost endless at this point. And it's just going to be this renaissance of on-orbit science that a new chapter in space exploration is opening up thanks to SpaceX and soon to be Boeing, the private industry driving the change.
Emily, what are you most excited about looking out for over the next few months when you focus on the space beat?
Yeah, I'm really excited to see what NASA and SpaceX say about how the capsule held up, what they learned from that. Right now, when it came back, it kind of looked like a really toasted marshmallow. And I'm curious to see what they say about how the parachutes held up, how the spacecraft did, if they'll make any changes before the next flight, which would be Crew One, and they're targeting late September for that. I mean, it feels like this year has been such a long year and we're only in August, and we're looking towards September for another launch with crew. That's really exciting to me that soon we'll have humans launching from the Space Coast on a regular basis. That's just something that's exciting because I know it's really good for our economy locally. People are excited to see those launches. It's just a different experience here and anywhere when you're watching a launch and you're knowing that there are humans on it and there's amazing feats of engineering that happened to make that launch happen and to get these guys back safely. So I'm pretty excited to see how things are in the next couple months.
Well, Emily Speck is a digital journalist and space reporter with WKMG. Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by 90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne. Brendan, thanks as well.
Anytime, Matt.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're online at wmfe.org/intersection. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone, free of charge. Now that service is as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit WMFE.org to make your contribution, and thanks. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.